Okay. Well, hello, everyone. My name is Claudio. I work for Amnesty International. And I work and research and mostly specialize on digital surveillance and targeted surveillance against civil society. I don't have a lot of time, but I'm going to try to speak very quickly. I have a little bit more slides than I probably should have. And you know, when we speak about digital surveillance of civil society, there's many aspects of this. The one that I particularly care about is targeted surveillance, so that the action of hacking or getting access in some way to activists, human rights defenders, and journalists' devices with some particular purposes. And this is something that we see a lot, and it's kind of growing as a threat, as an issue, significantly over the last years. And last year, particularly, we saw a lot of kind of high-profile cases that you might have heard about. The most prominent ones being the cases of NSO and in Mexico and in the Emirates, where there was this big story about these iPhone 0 days being utilized against some activists there. And what I want to talk today is not necessarily about these big cases that we get to hear a lot of the time, but just rather maybe what happens behind the scenes and what happens in less known cases that we don't get to hear about very often. The first premise is just surveillance enables repression. You know, when an authoritarian state, exercises control over its dissidents, the use of surveillance tools and use of surveillance technology is a direct contribution to this repression in the very first end. And as I was saying, we see a lot of this. You know, I spent some time mapping out all of the reports and all of the kind of discoveries that we had over the last few years, and most of them happened in the course of the last 5 years, really. And I wanted to see, like, is this a growing trend? And this is pretty much just the number year by year of how many reports have come out from different outlets that speak about this threat of digital surveillance and targeted surveillance against digital society, civil society. And what does this graph mean? It's just really not much. You know, we kind of have a lot of irregular discoveries, and some are kind of more concentrated than others in certain period of time. But what we can see at least is that there's just large blocks of pieces of research and discoveries that are initiated generally by one lucky first discovery. And some of them tend to be tied to specific countries. For example, 2012 was a big peak of discoveries and was kind of one of the first moments when this area of research became really a thing because of the situation in Syria kind of intensified over in that particular moment. And 2016 was also a big uptick because of all these big discoveries that came out. But this doesn't really show anything. There isn't really a trend. To me, it tells that this is an issue and a threat that always exists, and we're just getting to learn more and more about it right now. And there's two problems with it. One is that most of these discoveries originate just from a handful of countries. We don't really have a lot of visibility about what happens from a global scale, but it tends to be very concentrated in the places that we have kind of direct connections. And one of the issues, and I'll get to that a little bit later, is most reports are just authored by a handful of people. It's a very pervasive threat all over the world, but just not that many people tackle. And I kind of break it up in what are these threats that we see, and there's a bit of a pyramid that I came up with. Where there is kind of represents kind of a proportion of what is the real technical threats that we observe and that we try to work against. And at the very top, we have these big cases, the ones that we really get to hear about often and that make a big kind of media splash on newspapers and so on. So those would be the cases where 0 days are involved and like big companies and surveillance vendors are involved. And then there's like a middle stage where there's less sophistication but seems something quite prevalent. And the big corpus, the one that there are issues that we really don't get to hear a lot about are the less interesting one. Are the less technically sophisticated ones, but they're the large majority, in fact. And this, you know, has good and bad news. Bad news is there's very sophisticated, you know, and resourceful people and attackers out there that really invest a lot of money to surveil individuals at risk, surveil activists, journalists, and human rights defenders. And that is a problem. That is, of course, a critical problem that we have to talk about and deal with, also perhaps from a policy perspective. The good news is that, you know, in numbers, the large majority of people and the large majority of attacks that we see are actually not that very sophisticated. They tend to be pretty basic technical tricks and techniques that are utilized all over the place. But that is also bad news, because we're still failing hard at counteracting these issues despite being quite basic. And what I'm even more concerned of is that there might be an even bigger kind of bottom of this pyramid that we just not really never talk about, which is a whole other dimension of threats where physical surveillance comes in, online harassment and online intimidation. And that even something that we hear even less often than others. One of the big problems of all of this is that this pyramid is also kind of indication of where is the interest in the public, where is the interest in the media, and it tends to concentrate all the way to the top of this pyramid, where the only cases that really get to the surface that initiate some debate are just exceptions to the norm. And the very bottom ones tend to be forgotten or not even much talked about. And that is a problem because, again, those are the cases where a larger number of people get affected by. The very bottom, we have cases, for example, we worked on last year of fake NGOs and kind of weird trickery that is being set up to approach people and just talk to them, not even hacking any device or attack them directly, but just to get to learn information about their activities, perhaps de-anonymize if they're activists operating anonymously online, or in some cases just trying to figure out where they're physically located. And this happens a lot, and we just never hear about it. The largest portion is what I was saying, kind of credentials phishing, just attackers that are just trying to get access to people's email, to Facebook accounts, Twitter accounts. This is the just large majority of it. It's a trivial issue. It's a trivial attack, but it just happens all over the place. And this is another example that it's, you know, pretty common, you know, type of phishing attacks that just goes along with a lot of social engineering, where people chat up with individuals from particular countries, try to befriend them, and then at some point, you know, send them away to get targeted with some sort of credential phishing with the sole purpose of getting credentials out of them. And, you know, in the last year alone, even if we never get to hear about it, we have seen, and me and, you know, the community generally, hundreds and hundreds of people being targeted. It's a massive issue that we're just not tackling successfully. So just phishing, and so much phishing. It's trivial to orchestrate. Again, it's just the purpose of creating a fake kind of login page that might look familiar to the victim with the sole purpose of getting access to its credential. It's very easy to pull off. There's a lot of free and some commercial kits that are available online to do these kinds of attacks. And with appropriate social engineering, it's also extremely effective. You know, often we speak about, I speak about the issue of blaming users for falling for these kinds of things. The truth is that when there is enough kind of incentive in making people believe in the kind of social engineering that is being used against them, it's extremely difficult to tell apart from legitimate behavior. And in most cases, especially when it comes to attacking human rights defenders and journalists and so on, this is often the most effective tactic. You know, when you need to target people like those, what you want to get out of them most often is just identify contacts, colleagues, or sources in the case of journalists, learn about their plans, their communication, or even impersonate them to further attack others. And this is just, you know, as much as you need to, give them trouble, really. There's still cases, of course, where we see a lot of malware attacks. They're still frequent. They tend to be a little bit harder to pull off. These are the cases that tend to surface a little bit up to the attention of the public. But most often, as I was saying, they're rather unsophisticated. Most of the malware that we see, kind of malicious software we see being used against activists and civil society in general, is extremely basic. It's probably the worst pieces of software you'll ever see if you do technical analysis. And still, they're effective. Still, they're good enough to achieve a certain goal. And that, to me, is a bad sign also, because it means that either we're failing from implementing appropriate technical security controls, or just we're failing at finding ways around that and make the people safe. So what can we do about that? And what do we try to do? The first is kind of using media exposure as a tactic, and that's where I was getting at. A lot of this is research, getting research out for the public to learn about and somehow expect that things will just fix by themselves. And it can be useful in some exceptional cases, especially when these cases involve big companies or surveillance vendors that are a little bit shady, or particular countries that might be, you know, interesting or hot at this particular moment in time. It can be useful to increase cost of attacks. What we do sometimes when we publish about this stuff is not just to tell the public that this exists, but through the virtue of publishing, we manage to kind of destroy that operation at some point and make it a little bit more costly to pull it over and do it again and again. For the large majority, activists getting hacked isn't much of a story anymore, which is also makes it hard to come here and talk about it again and again. It's always the same issue. It's always the same problem. And the problem is that, you know, out of all these reports that we get to hear about, how many actually remember? It's just not that many. And so as long as the publication and coverage is the kind of the driving force behind doing this kind of surveillance research, we'll just keep failing all these people that just rely on us to keep them safe. And in terms of impact, in terms of actually changing things for all of these people, some of the most effective work is just done under the radar. It's just the most tedious and lesser known activity from kind of the activist community that comes out. And, you know, I always consider myself a researcher over the years. I just research these things. And at some point, the more I get exposed to the real dimensions of this problem, the real effect that surveillance has on people, especially people that put their lives at risk for a certain cause, I started realizing that it isn't really much about research anymore, and it's just really about helping people. And in terms of impact, again, some of this work can be extremely tedious. And there's some few good souls out there that do extremely boring work just to help people out. And we just don't get to hear about them, and I think we should. Some friends of mine, for example, spend every day, every morning, just going through all of these boring phishing campaigns to identify victims and trying to find any way to contact them and inform them that these things is going on. And it's in numbers, this is actually a lot more impact than most other things. We love tools, you know, we build tools to make people more safe. Tools are important to a certain degree. They increase the kind of the difficulty of performing certain attacks. However, most often when we actually look at it, a lot of these tools come from kind of us as in kind of privileged Western communities that find some issues and trying to resolve them. And often these issues that we identify are not really in the model, in the threat model of the people that we really should assist. And also, attackers learn and adapt. They see what's going on in the tech world. They see what's going on in kind of the digital activism world and you know, work around it. And often, these technical solutions alone are not really enough. So we need to get changes at a platform level. We just can't train every activist in the world to use some tool for the resistance, to learn about some new kind of cryptographic solution to a problem that isn't really their own. And we need to, if in some cases, for example, we equip them the latest kind of end-to-end encryption technology, and then at the end of the day, we'll just get hacked by some Office, PowerPoint macro or whatever other trickery that is available to any attacker that has a little bit of skills. And this is a problem that we need to address. We need to attract more expertise. As I was saying, I started doing this work 5 years ago, and pretty much the people that were working on those that are working on these issues now are the same people that are working on these issues back then. And it's just not enough. There's a huge demand for this work, for this assistance, for this research, and just a handful of technologies that are working on them. And I hope that I really don't see the day when we get to the point where something like the Cyber Bundeswehr or whatever else will just attract more hacker expertise compared to the human rights community. And often, I think it's a trend that we're moving forward to. We need to distribute expertise. Basic security expertise needs to be widely distributed. We need to dilute this bottleneck. There's a huge activist community in the world, and a lot of the technical expertise is just concentrated in a handful of places, one or two or three at most, with people that you can count on two hands, perhaps. And this is just not enough. It's just a bottleneck. I've swamped with stuff to look at, and I just don't have time for it all, and just the same way all of my colleagues. We don't have a lot of visibility right now. As we're seeing, a lot of the attacks that we see are attacks that come just from the same places, just because we establish some presence in that country, we created some networks and some contacts, but it's just not quite enough. And we need to move away, I think, from this concept that we're working within a digital rights environment. We need to move into a broader audience and move into placing this security expertise in human rights organizations, LGBT rights organizations, environmental, indigenous rights communities, and so on, to make sure that we're there at the right place at the right time when something bad happens. And we just not do that quite enough. We tend to segregate in this weird kind of digital rights bubble with some assumption that somehow everything will fix themselves and everybody will enjoy the results of our work. And lastly, I would say we need to stick together. We can't afford to be territorial or hyper-competitive. The digital rights community tends to be a little bit like that. And that is a problem, because then we're not going to be effective in helping all of the people that really need some help. And the only way to succeed is cooperate and leverage these human networks that all of these human rights communities and whatever rights communities have. There's a large presence of organizations all over the world that are facing these exact same issues that we just don't see them. And many are paying a hard price for this activism. Most of us can enjoy working out of a cafe in Berlin and like do our own activism through the computer. And there's many others. And the more you get to learn about them, the more you get to understand the significance of the work that we do as a digital rights community, as a tech activist community, or whatever you want to call it, where they put in their self out there, and they're putting their freedom, their lives out there in service of some other cause. And often the failure of the tech community, failure of kind of the security community, and some failures of our own too, could cost them really, really hard prices. And so to conclude, I think I don't really have much time left. I just want to remind you about some of these cases. And I remember about Basel. Hamed Mansour was the key kind of element that allowed all of these NSO and iPhone 0 days cases to come to light. And just because of his bravery in this, and also witnessing in realizing that something like this was happening, a whole dimension of other issues in many other places got discovered. And Hamad, as it is now, is still in prison in the Emirates, largely because of this activism and also because of his online, pretty much, activism. Ali and Peter, some of you here probably know them personally, and all of the other activists in Turkey that have been arrested in the last few months, they're all paying this price for these same activism we're so committed to, and they're still in prison right now. And so just the same with many others. So that is to say, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. There's many people that are doing great things and are paying good prices for it. And that is, to me, my kind of call for you to say, if you have some expertise, if you have some tech skills, if you have some other types of skills, just keep, think about and put it at service to some of these causes. And with that, I thank you. I know it's a bit of a condensed kind of overview of what's happening, but at the end of the day, you know, surveillance is an issue that will remain. It's not an issue that will go anywhere. If anything, it intensifies as the general kind of geopolitical situation in the world worsens by the day. And you know, we need to attract more of these expertise, more of these people, and just try to help each other out to make sure that people don't fall for the same mistakes again. Thanks a lot. If you have any questions, if you want to learn more about the details of what type of work we do, and if you might be interested in getting into this kind of field, please catch me later, and I'll explain you all more in detail. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Claudio. So important to put things into a global perspective, I think, and not just talk about these issues that we're discussing here on a German level. Of course, raises another level of sadness also on these topics. Are there any questions? We have 2 or 3 minutes left. If there are any questions to Claudio, you can raise your hand or come up to the stage. Very often, I'll ask a small question. It's maybe not the easiest one, but you know, very often, like this complete feeling of disempowerment for activists based in countries where we still have a relatively safe frame of operating with other friends sitting in jail. So you mentioned Peter, for instance, right at the end. And it's so often hard to say what the right thing to do is. Do you make a lot of noise? Do you reach out to your parliamentarians? Do you, you know, how do you behave in a way that is not going to endanger your friend? I'm not expecting you to give like a one-size-fits-all answer, but are there, for instance, people at Amnesty or other organizations that you can recommend where we can call and ask when in doubt in such cases?
Well, it is a difficult question, and it also depends on what are the specific, you know, conditions of you know, that particular case and that particular situation. We all try to do our best. As you know, kind of digital rights activists, sometimes we don't get the influence that we might want, but that's exactly what I was meaning at. We need to move out of this bubble. I think we need to get into kind of these larger kind of global issues that are not necessarily just about the internet. The internet is a tool for most, and we treat it differently, and it needs to be treated differently. But in this way, in all of these other kind of dimensions of activism, as it might be human rights and environmental and so on, suffer the same issues as we care about, but it just are not equipped to respond to this properly. And so the only way forward to responding to this problem and make sure that we can assist in a way that is most effective, I think, is to find exactly those places and not to just operate from a pure kind of isolated digital rights perspective, but look into kind of the effects that this has in other parts of society that we just don't get to see very often. So of course, Amnesty is a bit of a self, kind of a bit of a pitch for my own organization, but there's many others that work in very critical situation. And what I learned through the process of working in an organization like that is that there's a lot more that you just did not know about. And you get exposed to a lot more that you just never could think of before. And that's, to me, it's critical because that is just the only way to make sure that we can be at the right place at the right time to make sure that situations like some of that you've mentioned just don't happen again or don't have the same kind of impact and the same damage. So, you know, call up Amnesty, call up Frontline, call up all of the organizations that you can think of, Human Rights Watch and whatnot, ask them and see, you know, maybe even locally, is there something that I can help you with right now that might, you know, best leverage the expertise that I have? And it might be a critical moment for them to actually leverage you and change something in practice. So that is kind of the only thing that I can think of Everything else is kind of contextual.
Well, I think that is a very good call to action and a good point to end on. So let's have another big round of applause for Claudio. Thank you so much for being here today.